Thank you. And so at this point, I'd like to open up to questions. We didn't really allow questions of the panelists, so feel free to start with that. And then, well, I'm sorry. I thought you were. Wednesday, 10:30, and do we have the room number?
Minerals in the
house. Okay. Everybody get that? Great. Thank you so much. So we're ready to open up to questions. And again, what I'd like to do is to also ask questions of you. These are the questions that I have on the screen are fairly high level questions. What I want to try to orient us to do is you know, we started off by saying we asked a lot of these questions 2 years ago, and we got kind of high level comments that I summarized at the beginning. And I think you can see we're at the next level. You can see that we want to get a little bit more specific. The white paper, for example, had 152 research needs. We want input on how do we prioritize, what are the things that you're most interested in, getting down as granular and specific as we can. We'd also like to hear about activities that you are doing. As we are building this national climate assessment process, we need to know what's going on too, and how, you know, the information that you're developing can help feed in and maybe support some other people. So Tony?
John, I mean, it's almost have to leave to go to the 100th anniversary planning meeting, which ties in, and Linda mentioned that. Can there be a scribe for what's being discussed so that we can feed it into the 100th anniversary planning of the environment section?
Absolutely. We have a wonderful scribe who is taking notes. And in addition, again, I would like to encourage everybody to use that health@usgcrp.gov if things arise, you know, if you want to put things in writing, if you think after you leave, you know, of how you really want to put something, that's going to be a useful mechanism for providing input to us. And Tony, thanks for raising that. I do think that, you know, as a public-private partnership, we have a wonderful opportunity in the 100th and the centennial anniversary of the environment section to do a lot of communication and you know, getting the word out there. I'm sorry, I interrupt you for 1 second and ask everybody to do exactly what you're doing, which is when you do raise your hand, please identify yourself and where you are and, you know, whatever else you want to say so that we get to know each other in the room.
Okay. I'm Susie Wilkins, the State Office of Environmental Justice, and I'm a little bit of a bridge position because one of the biggest concerns that we have is beyond the issue of climate adaptation for the greenhouse gas emissions, but with the mitigation measurement, the mitigation impact of one of the major tools of carbon sequestration. And the concern is that it's going to be placing the greenhouse gas and maybe dealing with the air, but then creating a huge drinking water problem. And we've got a lot of activity going on in EPA that doesn't necessarily get in or nor include some of the wonderful, amazing work that's being done on the initial concern. And so I guess my question would be, A, with all of your efforts, have you considered the drinking water impact and the human health impact of contamination of drinking water supplies through carbon sequestration, which is an indirect, unintended consequence? So have you done anything? Can you do anything? And if so, what can be done so that it just doesn't become a black hole to people who are living in these areas who are bearing the burden of that activity?
Well, we are not looking at the unintended consequences of any mitigation strategy today. That's one of the tasks that we hope to build capacity within state and local to address as they move forward. Become engaged with what are the mitigation strategies that are afoot, what might be the pathways for health benefits and harm, and to provide tools like health impact assessment or some kind of other assessment that could then engage health in not only monitoring, but then again, predicting. So if that emerges as a community interest, our goal would be then to link the science on sequestration with the public health concerns and the data that they have there.
You know, I'll say there's a little bit of federal bureaucracy that gets in the way of that as well, which is we have the Global Change Research Program and we have the Climate Change Technology Program. And the Climate Change Technology Program is really the focus of a lot of the mitigation activities. And it, it's frankly, you know, it's a different silo, and there's been a lot of discussion about how we integrate what we're doing and how we talk about mitigation science and integrate the mitigation side of climate change in with the Global Change Research Program. You saw there we have a program element that's adaptation science, but not mitigation science. And part of that has to do with kind of the initial structuring of the federal enterprise. So I would reiterate that hearing this from the community would be very important to help make this happen if this is a priority. And I believe that there are probably parts of the EPA that are looking into this. In the water office, not at all.
Well there's a new...
I know there has been discussion.
A lot of
yeah.
activity, but the premise is that there are no environmental justice implications of carbon sequestration.
Okay. But aside from that, I was going to say, you know, if it was anywhere, it would probably be there. It's probably not happening in other places, and it is a gap. Okay, Kim, and then, what's your name?
Barbara.
Okay, Barbara, and then.
I'm Kim Knowlton. I work at the Natural Resources Defense Council at the Mailman School of Public Health at Columbia University. This is so exciting. Thank you all for your presentations, all of your work. I also represent the topic committee and the environment section at APHA working on climate change and health, and the committee people are really excited about this work because it's addressing a lot of the issues that we brought up in our meeting that was just yesterday. Part of our highest priority issues are trying to access better communication amongst ourselves as issues come up on climate change and health, like the National Climate Assessment that we did provide some comments on, and looking ahead to the future year, assuming that there's going to be a lot of movement on climate and health. We're asking ourselves, how can we sort of communicate amongst ourselves and then provide input in a really expedient way? And what you're talking about are setting up a community of practice that answers one question for us: how can we as a group sort of provide rapid input and communication amongst ourselves? We would like to sort of become part of that. So I'll talk to you, Kimberly, about that. The second issue, a question that we raised amongst ourselves, is this: in a time of so much climate change misinformation, active campaigns, it seems, in that regard, have you thought about, in light of this, you know, incredible wealth of information, will there be a portal or a means by which the public, the interested public, can go to find appropriate information that's coming from the science? And have you thought about designing like a communications place where the interested public, maybe within climate services, can find appropriate information? That's a tough one for a person in the public to find appropriate information that's a counterpoint to misinformation. We ask ourselves as public health professionals, how can we help our people out there and the public health practitioners in the field to try and do that? So that's an ongoing question and issue for us, but you might put that into your hopper of how you can help APHA folks to get there in the future.
So the general topic of how do we actually create the information portals to get information to the public is a very large area of discussion, and you're talking about a specific need that you would like to see from that portal, which is information that's organized in such a way that it's kind of addressing the key debates.
To the public in this regard,
right.
Which is the counterpoint to policymakers and decision makers, which has been another important part of your charge that you've described here in the programs that you're describing.
And so, you know, NASA has a very nice, you know, set of, you know, the 10 facts about global warming that does that kind of thing. We don't yet have that developed on the health side, and I think that it's useful to hear that that's a high priority. We're working right now on just how we're going to organize ourselves. And maybe I'll ask, I'm sorry, what's your first name again?
Marianne.
And Tanya, do you want to speak to that too? To talk about, you know, because they represent two different pieces of what we're trying to integrate.
Going to, but one of the big priority projects for USGCRP is likely going to be to help integrate and coordinate the participating agencies in making climate.gov, which is right now a NOAA climate portal, basically, into an interagency effort. And they've gotten the okay and the go-ahead to go ahead and move forward with making that an interagency site or portal. But we are going to be helping to kind of coordinate and lead that effort, working closely with some of the other staff at NOAA. So just let Marianne talk a little bit more about what climate.gov is and what the future may hold for it.
So contact.gov gave me NOAA website that website that NOAA developed to do basically exactly what you're saying, was to try and create the climate science in a way that was understandable to both the general public, but also serve the needs of those people who've been using our climate science for years, including other scientists. That is quite a challenge. And so right now that site is still under development, as Tony said, and as you mentioned, we're looking at broadening that into an interagency, U.S. government interagency website, so that you don't have to know that you need to go to NASA for this piece or to go to CDC for that piece. So that is one of the government's goals, is to try and create a one-stop shop for climate information for folks. Not sure no letter directly addressed sort of the debate issue. I will say that NOAA works closely with a lot of our scientific and professional associations, including the American Geophysical Union, AGU, the American Meteorological Society, and a lot of our scientists, including a NOAA scientist who's right now the president of AGU, and may have read recently in the news that AGU has just put out a call to their scientists, to their members, to find out who would be willing to do just that, to serve as outreach individuals on climate change science and to sort of counter some of the misinformation that's being put out in the general press. So rumor has it there's about 700 scientists so far who've responded to that. So their ability to respond in plain English will be varied. AGU will do their best to make sure that that is coordinated and they'll let it still come up the same. So if anyone
thank you.
If you have suggestions when you look at climate.gov for what you'd like to see on there, certainly send that to us and we will happily, we need all the feedback we can get on either what's working or what's not on that website.
Great. Can I see a show of hands again? We have Barbara, and then your name is?
Jean.
And?
Sonia.
Okay.
I'm Barbara Warren. I'm a retired physician. I'm at a career in community health, healthcare administration, and a degree in public health. I've been working in my community in a state which is very hot, very poor, bordering on an international community, and so we have a lot of challenges. I'm also a national board member of Physicians for Social Responsibility, so I have an interest in being involved in addressing climate change. So 2 years ago, we organized in our community a seminar, public seminar on the health effects of climate change with the help of CDC's Environmental Health, places and a speaker. We had discussion medical school and invited the public health school participants, trying to get involved, get the involvement of the local public health department and others in the state. We had a fairly fair degree of success with that, but nothing has followed in terms of those stakeholders being involved and moving the agenda forward. I was appointed to the city's climate change committee to address mitigation and adaptation, and I am the lone voice on health issues, and it's very difficult to get people to focus there. So I'm really excited to hear about the emphasis you're making in bringing in adaptation and mitigation issues around health. I think that we have a major problem with addressing silos within our communities and within our states. And I just heard that you have funded our state health department in Arizona. And we don't know about that yet. Maybe that's just because it's new. We have climate scientists within the University of Arizona who are very well known. They're doing their health research in their silo. And the public health department is very, very underfunded. It has very few staff to address this. I don't know about the state health department's involvement in these issues. I would like to see that through your grant processes and your interactions with state and local levels, that you require that there be networking and integration of the various stakeholder players to make all this be more effective.
You point to a very important problem, and one that's daunting. I mean, we're at this point, we're talking about, for your grant program, for our grant program, $4 or $5 million annually, which will not be able to cover the entire country. I know that for our grant program, we do have partnership requirements in your program. I'll let George speak to that. And we're also, you know, the goal of this national climate assessment is to start laying the foundation to break down the silos as much as possible. There are, you know, each agency has its own regional center network. The NOAA has the regional center network. The USDA has a very long-standing cooperative extension program. We're trying to connect all of those dots, and health is late to that field. So you're right, that is a challenge. It is an uphill challenge, but it is one that we are working hard to address. And George, do you want to say something about that?
You're absolutely right. It's the right kind of stakeholders at the right time. As we engage our public health departments, one of the initial challenges that they have is getting buy-in within the agency, within their peers. And this was mentioned by Kim earlier, that we've got to develop a message that makes health relevant in these settings. It's not just about, say, heat waves. It's about a wide variety of other impacts that will directly and indirectly affect the way you provide public health. And once we are able to do that, then we can broaden our sphere of influence and start with the unified voice as much as possible, and to engage the local and regional adaptation or mitigation activities that you're describing. But having access and buy-in from those academic partners and government partners is absolutely critical. I think our next challenge is to corral all these resources and be able to show
great.
And also, I think we need a lot more information on what I've heard today is phenomenal, but without that, we can't get very money for it. So we need that full information. Right. We've been about the CDC before, but we need to have a full information on that for communication.
Thank you. So I have Gina, Sonia. I'm sorry? In Phoenix, yeah. Right. So I have Gina, Sonia, David, Linda, and just in the interest of being able to hear from everybody, we'll keep our comments as concise as possible. George, you want to start?
This is, we have a branding program with an audience that we haven't well defined yet. And we have to not only figure out how we deliver that message and what the message is. Our overall goal is to really put a human face on climate change. It's not just about polar bears and penguins. It's about people. And it's not about 2010 or 2100 or 2200, that, like the way they frame the climate models. It's about now. About 10 years from now, 15 years from now, and making it relevant to the groups that we want to get to. Then we have to get all of the message about what we're doing now. And we are heads down in the weeds and put it up on our webpage and hope that everybody goes there. But you're absolutely right. It requires a, because our audience isn't just this audience. It's a wide variety of other communicators, science editors, different groups that really could use this message. We're struggling with that now. How do we go about doing it?
And just to amplify on that, I mean, it's about resources, message, information, and partnerships. We're working with pretty limited resources right now in terms of our communication budgets, our ability to do, massive kind of communication campaigns. So we're relying a lot more on partnerships. We're working on the messaging. I think that you know, most of the people in the room are aware of some of the seminal work that's going on in terms of how do you frame the issues in climate change for the public in ways that, that is acceptable. How do you deal with the cognitive challenges of an issue like climate change and health? You know, the enormity of the situation, the time, the time aspects, all of that. So I think it's not, we don't want to just kind of rush in the messaging. I think that we need to be thoughtful and deliberative in terms of how we actually create, you know, public communication, especially in a way that's effective and meaningful to people.
If you're not aware of the George Mason Center for Climate Change Communication, Ed Bainback and Sarah, their work is great at kind of giving us a handle on who we're speaking to.
And it's early, you know, there's more to be done there. And then in terms of information, you know, we're getting a start. And you know, this is a little bit of a one-stop shop of what we have now, and as we develop more, we're going to look for more, you know, innovative, creative ways to have this come out. And Kimberly?
I'd just like to say a little bit more about the process. Within GCRP, there's a communication, education, and engagement team that's been formed, interagency, you know, communication specialists from the different agencies that's working on the messaging, that's working on the 10 points, that's working on, you know, different ways of responding to the needs of different groups. It's fairly new and just getting going, but we do have plans to have listening sessions and engagement with various stakeholders and also with media and communication specialists to get advice on the best way to get these messages out once we've decided what the messages are. The Climate Adaptation Task Force has also convened a communication working group. So they're doing kind of similar and sometimes overlapping activities. So there's some of the same people, some different people, specifically for adaptation, looking at communication and messaging and you know, public awareness and education campaigns and all of these things. There's also, for GCRP, there's been a process of creating an overall integrated communications plan. So if you have any input to give, send it to health@usgcrp. You can talk to Tanya, you can talk to me, you can talk to John. But there's a whole variety of activities because everyone has, you know, every time we come to the table and we talk to stakeholders, the number one thing that comes up is communication. And it's you know, both directions. It's not just, you know, deluge us with information. It's show us how to use this information effectively. And we are trying to do that.
So we're struggling and there's a lot of process and we welcome input on it. So I have Sonia, David, Linda, and sir, your name?
Andrew and Ajay.
Okay, and that will probably do it for us. But.
My name is Sonia Ladrick. I'm still a student, an MD and PhD student, and I worked with the American Medical Students Association and students for positions for social responsibility. And we were doing these campaigns to try to get people to be active around climate change adaptation mitigation, and then realized that we had to take a step back because no one actually thought it was a health issue, so no one cared. And so I'm really excited that you're talking a lot about communication and education, and I've heard all the different communities you're thinking about addressing it to. So I'm wondering if there's anything specific that exists that we can use to educate public health and medical students about this as a public health issue to get them involved, how I can help you distribute those things, or if there's something we can do to put pressure on the schools to include that in curricula and stuff like that to build the next group of.
Yeah, so there's a lot of questions in there, and you know, because the schools and curricula is a whole other. There are a number of different groups that have put together really great presentations. There's a Climate Change and Health Literacy Consortium, I think is the name of it, that is working on putting together a presentation. The Association of State and Territorial Health Officials has a wonderful presentation from Ed Maybach on their website. The Climate Change Collaborative has a really good presentation there that is geared towards their audience, but I came across that, and I think that's a wonderful resource. The webinar, please talk about the book.
On getting this message out, we've held a series of 6 webinar sessions over the last year. John was one of the speakers, and we and Kim was as well, I believe. And what we've done is take each of those hour-long sessions, which are communication unit accredited by CDC, and we've developed what we call the coffee table book, which is a really slick book that encapsulates each of the presentations. There's 12 total, and along with the DVD of each of the presentations. So it could be a mini course, it could be a lunch and learn,
It could be a wide variety. It covers everything from Climate 101 by Dave Easterling of NOAA and CDC, all the way to Adaptation, Chris Eby and others, really talking about the full gamut of health engagement. So that's a good resource that you can get out to scientists and students alike. Probably not best for a public audience, but it really does.
But it's visually very nice, and so we'll appeal to a pretty broad. And I would just say, you know, this is an area, this is granular, and this is really going to require a lot of partnerships. So I would encourage people to think about what they can do locally and to kind of feed this together into a network as we work centrally to provide the best quality information that we can. Okay, David?
Yeah, I'm David Member. I'm a family doctor. I would love to know who we all are, and how many people are government or some sort of government. How many people are public health other than government states? Yeah, so we're probably talking to ourselves in a way, and you know, the listening needs to come from the community or with the county health. But my point is actually several. One, we need things we can do. Bicycling to me is one of them. Walking. The stairs, don't the escalator in the hotel, you know, dance, right? People sit there and watch. I mean, we have to have positive things we can give people about what they can do. That's one of the messages people are hearing. It's just like, I talked to somebody on the street yesterday. It's like, wants to build a, stop all the planes and build a train through the center of the country and we all get on. So I think there's a bit of a disconnect out of that. And the other is a little plug, Linda Marsa, who had an article in Discover Magazine called Hot Sound. Is writing a book about climate change. And I think oftentimes, and I'm bowled away, I mean, you know, I get there things and results, but I think a lot of it has to go to the public. And we have to reach out to the public, and I don't know how to do that best, but I would, you know, we've got to get to that point and figure out how we engage them and how we give them something to do. Because otherwise it just becomes a PTSD thing. Anyway, so.
Good points.
Okay.
Well, I did want to make a comment, and I am a journalist. I'm working on a book on climate change and health, and the launching pad of the book was a story that was the cover story in December, Discover, which Kim Milton inspired, you know, and I know I'm embarrassing her. But here's what I want to tell you guys, and I shouldn't be participating because I'm not supposed to do this as a journalist, but here's what I think, just a suggestion, and this is from Tom Friedman, this is not my idea. You guys have got to get with broadcast meteorologists. This is who you've got to get with. Every time there are 26 tornadoes in Chicago in an afternoon, they need to get on there and say, well, here's more evidence of climate change. Every day and every way, it needs to be hammered home into people's heads that the climate is changing, that when you are having 103 degree heat in November in Los Angeles, that is climate change. When you're having, we had 113 degree heat in Los Angeles, and it could have gone higher, but the thermometer broke. You had 110 temperatures in Moscow for over a week. Putin finally admits there is climate change. This is what, I mean, this is my suggestion. You guys have got to get with the broadcast meteorologists. It's very nice that you have these places that you can direct people.
And it's actually happening too.
But you've got to bring them on board, and every time.
Well, NMS is usually at these meetings, and they've got a good message, and they're getting their community involved. But the broadcast journalists, broadcast meteorologists, who most don't have a science background, haven't a clue about climate change, and it's a big challenge. Right, you've got to get with them. How do you? That's overcoming the general public's.
But Dr. Luger, this is where you have to start.
Yeah. Let's hear about what's, because there are things that are happening, and I'm not sure.
Yeah. Okay. Well, my boss is actually a federal representative on the American Meteorological Society as a committee on station scientists, which is designed in part to address this issue that George was referring to, that a lot of the broadcast meteorologists don't actually have degrees in meteorology, and so they are not scientists. And so they recognize their biggest challenge is that, or their biggest complaint back to NOAA or criticism back to NOAA is, we have a hard time predicting the weather past 5 days. What makes you think you can predict what the climate will be like in 100 years? And that's a very difficult criticism to overcome with people who are not scientists. So we've been working with the Committee on Station Scientists to try and address that with the broadcast meteorologists We're at their conference on broadcast. The broadcast meteorologists have a conference every year. But it is a very big challenge to overcome in terms of their mindset. It's also a challenge to overcome in terms of the news directors, giving them time to discuss this as a part of the weather broadcast.
And I would point you as well to... The National Environmental Education Foundation, is that what you're going to talk about? So the National Environmental Education Foundation actually has a program that's doing just this, and I saw one of the most wonderful little video clip of a weather broadcaster, I think it was in Austin, Texas, somewhere in Texas, who, with unbelievable skill, in 60 seconds, merged the themes of climate change, active living, and human health in just this perfectly, you know, so it is going on. It's a community that is hard to get into. You are right to point to that. And, you know, we need to do more of it.
Yes.
Did you want to say something?
I was just going to quickly say that. I mean, one thing we did in the field of aging was to engage the journalists who write about aging, and they're often in the health feed, but to get that message through there. So it might actually be convening a meeting to bring people in for teaching for those very people who are on the front. I mean, that's a...
So... Henry?
I'm Henry Jamison, University of Nebraska's new College of Public Health. Actually, we have a course on climate change and health that we've been running for 4 or 5 years now. But as you well know, changing academic and research settings is very difficult. I just want to make a couple of suggestions quickly. One is you're doing a lot of work to localize and regionalize the effects of climate change and then to adapt. It might be useful to use that structure also as feedback to people locally to motivate mitigation efforts in the same regions. For instance, I thought among the CDC's suggestions of cooling centers for neighborhoods was one of the most interesting. But if the cooling centers could also lead to people actually cutting down on the air conditioning at home, then we can have mitigation effect as well as an adaptation effect. So localizing mitigation according to the adaptation map, I think, would be useful. Another is the fact that the climate change big effects to health map that you have a model for Jonathan Pass and actually Tony McMichael before him and so on. It's not very ecological, it's just one way. Actually, human health and population have a big effect on climate change. And certainly, as things heat up and as we adapt, we need more medicine, which is very expensive, uses a lot of fossil fuels. I think if we try to close the loop and use human health not just as a motivator to act on climate change, but also to understand how human health actually affects climate change, you could help people get a deeper understanding of why they need to change. Third is, by the way, I really admire what you're doing. I think it's really important. Third quick suggestion is, I know Ed Mybach's, I follow your webinars, Ed Mybach's work is really good and very interesting, but my experience in public health is people are not much motivated by their health, by and large, especially their long-term health into old age. But I do think they're motivated by the health of their children, and I think that might be a stronger selling point than human health per se. Just one last question, though. I hope you don't mind.
Nope. Please.
At least for me, I see you doing all this great stuff on adaptation. It's really, really needed. At the same time, I'm very fretful about the mitigation problem, and it looks like very little will be done, and your adaptation problem will just grow exponentially as the decades go by. Doesn't it make you all nervous if you're working so hard on adaptation and really don't have a hand in what's going on about mitigation, and how are you trusting that something will be done at that end? Because if we don't mitigate, all the rest of what we do will fall into the crashes.
I'll address the last one as, you know, fairly briefly. I mean, you are spot on, of course. Motivating the global community to actually mitigate climate change is the primary goal if you were really concerned about the issue. We are the public health community, and we have tools and levers that we can pull. And, you know, we have not been you know, one of the communication messages is, you know, is that we have to be doing something to, you know, with so much of the population denying that anything is actually happening, there is probably some communication value in saying, okay, now we have to deal with it. But your fundamental point is a good point, and you know, there are a lot of different ways to do that. Some of that is there has just been, you know, tremendous difficulty in taking that head on and saying climate change is coming. We all have to change the way we live in order to do something about it. That has not been something that has gained traction for 25 years. And one of the things that we're trying to do within public health is to look at what are the behaviors that would actually lead to those kind of mitigations. You've referred to some of that when you talk about cooling centers, and to try to find ways to encourage and promote those behaviors, you know, from our community, because we can only, you know, we're not the energy community, we're the health community, and we have to use health-based messages, but a lot of the health-based messages are in this realm of co-benefits, are in this realm of, you know, if we design our communities in different ways, if we change our own health behaviors, that has benefits for that's cooling the planet too. That's one way we can do it, but you're right, it is the...
I think you're quite right that you're doing this work, by the way. It's just that...
Your point is well taken.
No. About the other side.
And the more that we can do that, you know, you're absolutely right, the better off we are. Did I skip somebody in going back? I know... Kim, did I skip? Okay. Yes, sir, Adrian.
So I'm Ajay from the Child First Consulting Group, and I know my interest is to have a problem who I work with for quite a bit. So my question is framing, and I appreciate the work that CDC has done in really turning this argument away from what's going on 100, 200 years from now with sea elevation and more tangible things, like vector migration, respiratory problems, things are really tangible to eat. But my other question, is there the ability within the scientific community to take advantage of the current physical environment, which is to say, a lot of opportunity in climate change, perhaps to make an economic argument for what we're doing, and whether some of the modeling data, for instance, on heat, you can show a decrease in ER visits and what that might mean, and that message should help advance sort of health and outcome data, which typically for health impact assessments would take much longer in terms of some of the data we need. I mean, I just didn't know how that's being built into some of the modeling, but it might be a compelling case to push the data.
You're absolutely right. That's something that we've been hearing over the past year. Can you provide some costing data that if we do this, we're going to realize these impacts? And we hired a health economist this summer, and he's starting with our program, and one of the first tasks is to work with EPA in their integrated assessment modeling group on a specific pilot we think it's going to be Austin, Texas, and develop a really comprehensive approach to understanding impact, this integrated assessment approach to climate impacts and outcomes, and then costing money, costing data on that with hospitalization and healthcare expenditures. We have the platform in Austin through our collaboration that we're going to present this afternoon with a wide variety of data that we can actually do these types of outcomes. And we keep hearing that time and time again. So yeah, we're hoping to develop some strategies. A little bit of work University of Delaware has done on that.
Kim, did you want to say anything about your work? Or?
I think that might be the connection back to your question about what's going to do with mitigation, maybe when the cost of adaptation or what the impacts are right now is brought to bear, maybe that'll help move both arguments. So that's really exciting work.
We have appropriation language that's really specific. That this is often what comes to CDC, and you will do this, and it's adaptation, and it's the message. If we are to advance that agenda, we've got to sneak in the back door. And we've got to get the people that we fund to make these arguments and show the data on their local level about how they're going to make an impact and how the decisions that are made at New York City are going to make on mitigation, how that we can leverage health benefits and help them promote that. That's our strategy now because we can't take it on head on.
And this is also a piece of our research prioritization process. I mean, if health economics is one of those elements, please let us hear this. I cut you off.
I did have a question.
Yes, yeah, you were in the queue for a question, too.
And my question was about the surround approach, about targeting individuals, about what they can do to adapt. I guess this is for you, George. It sounded like that was targeting individuals and what individuals can do more,
caregivers of individuals. So one example was high school athletes dying of heat-related illness, and to educate the coaches and athletic trainers on how to observe a person in danger, how neighbors can watch each other, how a pharmacist, when they dispense medication, is supposed to deliver a specific message. Mm-hmm. So when a heat wave gets alerted, we we send out texts or something, tweets or whatever, to these groups that can then provide an additional source of health messages.
So beyond that, with our community groups,
yeah,
and groups being targeted as well in your outreach efforts?
Yeah, Meals on Wheels, for example, you know, for that,
okay,
or other outcomes that might be different groups.
Because I'm thinking about the groups and the community groups that are already into a climate justice frame, beyond just the immediate caregiving individuals around the individuals that are being impacted. I would assume that, because you've been strong, and all of you in your work have been strong on the groups that are making up the communities that are impacted, that I'm assuming is part of the frame.
All right. We are running out of time. We're going to close it up and get the people who have their hands up. I just want to point people to these questions again, especially the idea of the community practice, and encourage you to think about it and give us the feedback through the mechanisms that we've identified. I'm sorry, you had your hand up. I forgot your name, Laurie. Did you want to? You had said, wanted to respond to that? Yeah. And that's a great example of how really important health-related work is going on in agencies other than Health and Human Services. I've been providing a little bit of a Health and Human Services focus because that's been the biggest growth in the last couple of years, I think. I mean, NASA's been there, NOAA's been there, EPA has certainly been there. So that's a really great example. Barbara, anybody else?
A quick question on whether or not anybody's doing anecdotal research into the health impact of existing energy sources like coal, which if we get rid of the coal and coal waste, we will be and replace it with renewable energies, we'll be doing mitigation and we'll be addressing health impacts. Is that information that anybody has data on?
Well, certainly the EPA has reams of data on that in their cost impact, you know, cost benefit analyses of their air pollution regulations that can be used for that. But as far as this kind of integrated, you know, things like came out of the National Academy report of the, I forget the name of it, but the cost of energy, the hidden cost of energy, yeah.
$62 billion in existing costs of air pollution.
I think that's probably the best example of that.
Power plants in the U.S. today, I think it was $62 billion, right?
Yeah. Yeah, that's a very important piece of this. Last comment.
Hi, my name is Chris Oya. I'm CDC and National Center for Atmospheric Research postdoctoral fellow. Highest priority issue is, let's think this quickly. I think there's been a lot of progress in the last 5 years on things like flu, things that we know are environmentally and climatically sensitive, but we can translate this knowledge into tools that actually save lives and quantify those. Number two, greatest needs, data. I'll just make a plug for long-term data sets. There's not enough help. Things like sentinel sites. We don't have a central climate change network site, something like that, where we can anticipate human material climate change needs, because we have some things that are already in progress, but there's a big barrier in terms of the next having enough data then from there to actually show that there's other health outcomes. And my guess is there's at least two or three times as many important environmental health outcomes that we haven't really looked at.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm going to generalize the first thing you said, which was you had mentioned flu, and you know, I think there's a lot of seasonality in a lot of different diseases that hasn't been tapped sufficiently, and things like flu are among the very major drivers of morbidity and mortality. And so, is it all right if I generalize? You know, flu is a good place to start, but
yeah,
there's probably, and what you're saying is that there's a lot of seasonal changes in incidence, and we need to mine that to understand climate influences and incorporate that.
Yeah, and there's been enough advances that we can actually make tools that will save lives today.
Yes, yes. Thank you.
I should work that out.
Yeah, careful what you ask for. I learned that.
I just want to give one last plug. On behalf of the climate assessment, one of the key things, we have a particular staff person that's really looking at dedicating her time specifically on the engagement process and building the stakeholder networks within the regions and sectors. And so one of the mechanisms that they've already got under hold to build these bridges and identify those things was this online newsletter. I think we're already at 3 or 4 that have come out already. And so if you are interested in continuing to get updates on the assessment process and don't yet receive that newsletter, either feel free to let me know, or if you go to the globalchange.gov and the assessment part, you can sign up. And the program as a whole is looking at leveraging that that newsletter to expand beyond just the assessment as a strategic element. And they're already starting to include some of the adaptation science work that's going on, and we'll continue to broaden as we further develop the other areas that John alluded to. So if you are interested in figuring out more about what's going on with the program, sign up for that.
Great, thank you. George, did you have a last word that you wanted to give?
Thanks for your interest.
Thank you, everybody. It's great. Very helpful. There's